As usual, I like to start with opening it to any question from last week or any previous thing or just general questions or comments that anyone has.
Last week you said something that really was powerful for me. You were talking about empathy and self-connection and how for some people that's really the most powerful thing. So I've been thinking a lot about responses to empathy and the people that self-connection isn't their primary thing. And that's difficult for me when people really want to tell their story. And I guess maybe I just don't have a lot of empathy for that. So that's one thing, is like how other people respond to empathy. And if I'm in a circle and we're specifically there for listening and doing empathy, then it seems that self-connection is very powerful. But if I'm in an everyday conversation with someone, giving empathy isn't always as powerful.
Yeah, I want to make two distinctions. One is between reflection and connecting with feelings and needs. And another distinction is between the experience of being heard and the experience of doing inner deep work for healing. Do you see where I'm heading?
Say more.
Okay, so the form of empathy that most people who are trained in NVC encounter is the form of empathy that is used in workshops where people want to do their personal growth, personal work, learn, grow, heal, etc. That form of empathy is when the person who is empathizing supports the person who is receiving empathy and connecting at the deepest level possible to have an experience of healing. And usually we do that by focusing on feelings and needs, slowing down, you know, sitting with the need, all these good things. They are wonderful when there's an agreement between two people that that's what we're doing. That's not there in daily life.
Right. That's the big thing, isn't it? The agreement.
Yeah, it's not there. And it's not there not just because of agreement. It's also, there's always the question of what is the purpose at hand. And one of the ways that I think NVC discredits itself is by people using it in identical manners in all contexts instead of adapting it to the context. Let's say I'm in a business meeting. Anyone could see immediately that it doesn't make sense to do deep reflection of feelings and needs. That's not what we're there for. However, in any context, reflecting what you get is important to the other person provides immediate relief and a sense of being heard. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So somebody says, you know, that person is an asshole. They told me they were going to make the report on time, and look at it, it's 2 weeks later. They never really intended to do it on time. You know, I'm just making it up. It's incongruous to say, I really get a sense of the depth at which you experience your desire for alignment around, doesn't make sense. That's not what's going on. However, saying to that person, you know, I really get
how angry you are.
How angry you are, or that this is really important to you, or that you depend on other people keeping their word to be able to do your own work. You know, whatever it is, on the surface, content only provides immediate relief from being heard and understood. Did that answer your question sufficiently?
Yeah, that's great.
Thanks.
I had a train situation this week. I was trying to reflect with somebody who definitely in a lot of pain and sort of holding on to it. Well, this is my interpretation.
It's getting worse, the line. I'm just going to make use of what you said so far. Just this frame, somebody's in a lot of pain and holding on to it. This frame,
yeah,
makes you less of a useful presence in that person's life in that moment. Do you understand why?
There's no connection.
There's no connection, there's no love. Mm-hmm. If somebody is in pain, what they need is your presence and your love. If you have a judgment instead, and let's face it, saying someone is holding on to their pain is a judgment. It's a judgment because we all believe that it's better to let go of the pain or to be open or to let it flow or whatever, however we frame it. No one is saying, oh great, you're holding on to your pain, you know? So if you have that frame on the other person, you will see them through that frame. You're not going to be useful to them. So you need to work on your end. Do what you need to do to release as much of it as possible so you can meet this person with love.
Gotcha.
Sure. Anything else from anyone? Any questions from last week or from anything?
Following up, I have someone who is coming with a lot of pain, and I've been trying to, really, I did have a lot of presence and a lot of love initially, but it's a repeat each time, and I know that indicates that I'm not getting it, or if I did, there would hopefully be some relief for her.
So one of the things that we all bring with us, and it's a very difficult thing to let go of, and it's kind of like the last stronghold of our habitual patterns, and I completely own to having that too, is the desire for the other person to feel better.
Yeah, you said last time that that's just not necessarily going to happen.
Yeah.
That we need to be detached from the outcome.
It's not exactly detached from the outcome, it's open to the outcome. Because detached somehow means that I am not connected and it's not affecting me.
Okay.
I want it to affect me because my affected humanity, my affected heart, is the asset that I have to offer the other person. It's being completely connected and available and open to whatever happens without being attached to this or that particular outcome. It's an incredibly paradoxical stance.
Could it mean that we are responding in a way that says, I see that each time that you've come, you are saying pretty much the same things?
No, that is not an observation. The accurate observation is, I see that I am not able to hear nuances or difference between what you're saying today and what you said last week. I'm hearing the same thing. I'm sure you're telling me different things. I am not hearing the difference. So I am limited here. I want you to help me. You see how different that is?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Because, yes, probably there's repetition going on. It's not what's going to create connection. What's going to create connection is the more you can clean yourself from any sense that you know what's going on. All you know is your inner experience. That's the only thing you know. Okay?
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So with that, I am shifting attention to the topic of power. And once again, I'm becoming very aware that in some ways, so many of the topics that we have covered so far lend itself to a whole class of its own. And definitely this is true for the topic of power. So what I would like to do is to start by just saying two things and then put you in a group to engage with your responses to these two things. The first is the definition of power, the capacity to mobilize resources to meet needs. That's just the definition, the capacity to mobilize resources to meet needs. Actually, I see that it would be more accurate to attempt to meet needs, because we don't ever know when we attempt to meet a need whether or not it will be met. And then when we look at what resources are, essentially anything is a resource, And just the big distinction around resource is between external resources, which are material resources, social resources, physical resources, access to organizational structures. All of these things are the external resources that we have, and internal resources, which are what we have inside of us, our knowledge, our level of self-connection, our capacity to make sense of life, our critical thinking, all of these things that are inside of us. So that's all I want to say for the moment. And I want to get you into groups of three. So what I want you to do in the group is to do two things. One is to look at this definition, looking at power as the capacity to mobilize resources to attempt to meet needs, and how you relate to this definition. Does it make sense to you? Does it not? How do you feel about it? Does it provide relief, anxiety, etc.? And the other one is to look at what resources are, how we open up the question of resources so that it's not just money, all the resources that we have, and how you relate to the resources you yourself have, both external and internal. That's what I'm asking you to do in the group. Let's do this for 10 minutes. Welcome back. The floor is open to take a closer look at the initial definition of power and resources.
We had a great group and agreed that the definition is very powerful and empowering. And then I wondered about, and I brought this up just as an example, that the American Congress, both sides are choosing not to act. And there's power in that, and it's not necessarily from an internal storehouse of spiritual wisdom, and it may be from an external point of power, but I took issue with that and wondered how that fits into the resources that we have in this handout.
Before we're getting into the specific example, I want to... Okay, Kate wants to add something. Go for it, Kate.
For me, the point was really came up when we were looking at the definition, and it was about the word mobilize. Because sometimes inaction, we were talking about what can inaction do.
What can inaction be?
Resources? Yeah, are we still mobilizing resources if we are not acting?
Yes, it's not related so much to power as to, in some ways, this is a very hard concept to integrate. I'm still struggling with it sometimes. There's no such thing as inaction. There's always a choice to take a particular action. For example, when you say that there's inaction on the part of the Congress, what I am interpreting, and I don't even know what you're talking about, but it doesn't really matter. What I'm interpreting is that they are making other things their priority. How does that fit with you as a reframe of inaction?
I get that in one sense, but also what about the sit-down protest? I mean, all I could come up with was using the internal resource of presence and perhaps, you know, the strategy of meditation.
Meditating is action. It's not inaction. Sit-down protest is action. You're putting your body somewhere.
And so what would you say are the resources that you're using then?
So can you now flesh out the example, and maybe it will be easier to then look it at? And what are you talking about? The two parts of the Congress are both not taking action.
There is a state, Wisconsin, in which the Democrats, and this is an action, I agree, that they decided to leave town and leave the state rather than act on what the governor wanted to put forward. That is taking an action. But what are the resources they're using?
So the resource that they are using, first of all, there is the physical resources. They are using access to money to transport their bodies elsewhere. That's very simple. However, there are consequences to their action. And one of the resources that they have is the structural power that they have, so that whatever they say to each other and when they raise their hand about something or however they vote on anything, in general, even though in this case they're choosing to do something else, they have power in the sense that what they vote on in that building affects other people, becomes law of the country. That's a structural resource. You can speak to me, you can raise your hand in as many buildings as you want. It's not going to be law. You see?
I understand what you're saying.
Any comments?
Well, so it seems to me that everyone has power. There's no one who doesn't have power.
Exactly. It's just, what is the extent of the power? In other words, I do not have the power to meet my need for peace in the world. I have the power to meet my need for inner peace. You see the difference?
Yes.
Now, it gets really exciting when you start thinking about what happened in Egypt. Because when certain individuals have structural power, in other words, they have access to resources in the sense that what they say carries a certain influence that what you or I or any other Joe Schmo says doesn't carry that influence. You with me so far?
Yes.
Part of what gives them power is your and my agreement that they have this structural resource. However, neither one of us alone can take back that resource from them. A million or 2 million people all at once who say, we're no longer in agreement. Together, they have that power. That's why we had in those materials the piece that talks about relational resources. Other people's agreement to our power is part of the resources that we have. That is both part of explains why it's so hard to change things and why it's possible to change them. Because you have to line up a whole lot of people to create a certain kind of change. You wanted to add something?
I'm just getting it. Of course, that I really like this other layer, which I didn't get from the notes, actually, is about having other people agree of the usefulness or the weight of the power that we do have, or that, say the people in Egypt did have. I've just got the first layer was something about awareness of the fact that we have power, and that being an internal resource, which is something like choice.
Yes.
And then the next piece is, the next layer is having the world kind of see and hold that power as something that we're having dialogue with or noticing or...
I'm not sure that I'm following what you are saying.
I'm just trying to get the piece about that people have to line up in order to...
Okay, so Hosni Mubarak had the power to rule Egypt. Part of the resource that he was mobilizing in order to do that was other people's fear of him. One person losing that fear gives that one person power to shape their life in a different way. It doesn't change the structural conditions in Egypt, because there's still all the millions of people in Egypt minus one. It's overwhelmingly more. So Hosni Mubarak has the same amount of resource, essentially. However, when a million people together say, we're not giving you our fear, you don't have access to it anymore, then he has less power and ends up resigning.
So I'm so intrigued about calling fear a resource. Really.
My fear is the other person's resource, because it means they have more capacity to act on behalf of their needs because of the fact that my fear will keep me from trying to get in their way. It's very blunt. Very simple and basic. In political theory, they call it legitimacy. What's the legitimacy of a ruler? It's either your love and trust in the ruler or your fear of the ruler. Either way, the ruler has some power as a result of what you feel and do.
Thank you.
to me, there is something so strikingly basic and simple about this in terms of thinking about how we can change anything. And part of the subtleties are such that when I lose power, people around me notice that. Intuitively, you know when somebody says, everybody now sit down, and one person says, no, I'm not going to sit down, you immediately have some relationship to that person that doesn't sit down and go, ah, there's something there. Isn't it true?
Yeah.
So if any one of us loses fear, we become more powerful. We have more inner resources to mobilize, and other people will notice. This is part of how leaders emerge. Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to shift to see, did you want to say something?
I appreciate this concept of transcending my own fear to really mobilize my power.
Yeah. Thank you. I want to then add one more thing, which is that there are two relationships between external and internal resources that together help me understand a lot of what is happening in the world in terms of distribution of resources. So one is that, unfortunately, if you are born into a family or class or country or town or someplace where there are a lot of external resources, you're more likely, nothing is determined by anything, but you're more likely to also develop at least certain internal resources. For example, if you go to a school in a place that middle and upper class people go to, you are given the message that you can do anything you want in life. If you go to a school that lower class people go to, you are more likely to get the message that you are lucky to get a steady job. Maybe focus your attention on getting a trade and don't set your goals too far because you don't have a chance. Getting these messages then affects your own relationship with yourself in terms of how much confidence you will then have to meet life. This is just one example. So external resources that we grow up with have a relationship with our internal resources. And I want to pause here before I say the second relationship to see if anybody has any reactions or questions to what I've said so far about resources. This is a lot of very intensive, fairly radical concepts all at once, so I want to give you time to digest. I want to hear from at least one person what this conjures up for you.
I feel sad hearing that and thinking of growing up in a middle class suburbia. I seem to have been given the message that there's an inequality of resources just throughout our society. And yes, I was encouraged and shown many opportunities that I could achieve whatever it is that I wanted, while at the same time certainly given the message that there's savage inequalities and it's my job in order to fix them, and having an associated shame and guilt about that.
Thank you. I am really appreciating your openness and vulnerability in sharing this. I just want to stay with you for a moment. How is it for you to share this?
Different things are coming up, like getting through the embarrassment to just, like, maybe a slight, maybe just niggling sense of, like, relief or, like, openness to be able to put it out in the open.
So I'm telling myself that in order to be able to share this, especially on the phone with people you don't necessarily know very well, you mm-hmm. had to have done some work on the shame already. To have enough self-acceptance that you can say, I have shame.
Oh, yeah.
And the other thing that comes to mind is that shame, that kind of shame, not just for you, but for anyone that has that particular kind of shame, interferes with having full access to your power. Do you see how that would be?
Just in the same way that fear maybe debilitates the opportunity to take action?
Yes. It's like there is kind of like a level of hiding or holding back that prevents you from putting your full self out with total authenticity. And that takes energy and deprives the world of the fullness of you. Thank you.
I'm still sitting with the question of how is it that access to external resources has an impact on internal resources. One thing that I appreciated was it was said in the notes about beliefs about entitlement. I think I'm still wrestling with that around deserve thinking, and I think maybe I have a little bit of fear around thinking that I'm entitled to anything because of creating an expectation, or we're playing in that deserve area that I'm a little bit wary of.
Here is a very simple example how this shows up. Suppose you call a doctor's office and they tell you, you know, the next appointment we have is in 4 months. If you have a belief in entitlement, and I don't even mean it in a negative way, just a sense that, you know, I want to advocate for my health. You might say, look, I have a serious condition, and I need to see a doctor before 4 months. Can you look to see if you have any opening, or maybe he can squeeze me in, or she can squeeze me in, or put me on your waiting list and let me know when you have a cancellation, or any of that stuff. Simple, basic stuff. If you have a belief in entitlement, you're more likely to do this and more likely to get better health care as a result. Someone else who is raised with the idea that they're not entitled to anything, you know, they're grateful if they got anything from anyone because they're basically, you know, the undeserving, then they're not going to say this. They're just going to wait the 4 months, and meanwhile their condition can get much worse. It's on that, even on those basic level, that it affects. Does that help in understanding what I mean?
Yeah, I certainly have more to do around seeing ways of advocating for myself. And also, I think I have a lot of mourning to do around times when I haven't.
Yeah, thank you. So that's the one relationship between external and internal resources, which is that when we have access to external resources, we're more likely to have access to internal resources and capacities to cultivate internal resources. For example, people who have access to external resources are more likely to take NVC classes, which definitely develop our internal resources. The second is that when anyone doesn't have access to external resources, they need more internal resources in order to have power. Because it's almost like needing to have enough internal resources to make up for the lack of access to external resources. And so in that way, the people who have less access to external resources have a double thing that gives them less access to power. First, they don't have access to external resources. Second, they don't have access to enough internal resources to counterbalance the lack of access to external resources. This is the picture that we live in, and this is where I see a great deal of desire to find a way to give people who don't have access to external resources more access to internal resources, because I cannot change their external circumstances. I do, if I can find a way to connect with them, I do have the capacity to offer more internal resources. That's one of the things that I want to do with the NVC skills that I have. So I want to pause again and see if there are any comments or questions, and then if not, move to the next topic. Any more comments on external resources and internal resources?
I suppose if we had the verb kennen, my gut just says it's too much thinking. It's in the body. It's a place to go. The opening comes out of experiential knowing.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than out of thinking and analysis. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's the body's reaction to it.
So that's your reaction to what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I want to connect with it more because I'm not confident that I understand what you're trying to tell me.
Neither am I. I'm just sort of voicing what I'm sensing in my body.
So is it some kind of an overwhelm and a desire to trust your own body knowledge in these areas?
I guess you could say it that way. Yeah, I'm a little overwhelmed with all the thinking and think that trusting my body to know where the access is much more effective. I think Gandhi would have approached it in terms of prayer and meditation to find the appropriate thing to do. Similar to his prayer and meditation prior to the figuring out the salt march.
Yes. I am 100% with you with just this little twist, which is that this knowing that you have, that you can access your body knowledge, that you can meditate or pray or do some practices that give you more body knowing, that in and of itself is already an internal resource. Not everyone has it.
Yes, and it's an enormous resource.
Yes.
It's an unrecognized, enormous source of power.
Absolutely.
And the Salt March is a sort of a good symbolic way of recognizing that. One person ended that law by putting a flake of salt on his tongue.
It wasn't one person. It was many people.
All mobilized by his finding the spiritual connection with all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Then taking that symbolic action that drew them
yeah.
all in.
And any one of us, in theory, could do that.
Yes.
And yet we don't. That's where it gets interesting for me. Why don't we? What do we need to do in order to become more and more powerful so that we could even imagine that we would do something like this? I don't have an answer. I just wanted to give you the question.
I think the answer is in sharing NBC sufficiently so that you create a spiritual awareness similar to what Gandhi had in India when he took those actions.
Yep.
Some recognition, some sympathetic connection.
Thank you.
Two things that I thought of. One is, how do you account for, with the explanations that have been brought forward, the angry and upset youth? I'm talking about teenagers and college kids who are feeling so powerless they're taking their lives with drugs and drink. And the second is, where then does prayer, because the poorest of the poor people pray all the time to
mm-hmm.
God. I mean, they're extremely devout, and that's an internal resource. Why then are they not accessing their power? So those two examples came to mind.
Thank you. So I want to do the second one first because it's clearer to me. I don't know. This is what my intuitive thinking is, that this is why, you know, there are some people like Karl Marx who are very worried about religion. You may have heard that Marx was referring to religion as the opium of the masses. So I've thought about this a lot. And I think that religion and spirituality can be used in different ways. So there is also liberation theology. So liberation theology actually came from Latin America. And these are people who rethink the teachings of the church and lining them up, combining them with social justice. And so it becomes something different. So how that relates is this. You can pray in a way that is designed to make you accept your lot and not try to make waves. Like, for example, the habit of saying praise the Lord about whatever happens. The message in there is God is larger than me, And it's not for me to decide what needs to happen. I just need to accept what is and live my life. That's a message that sometimes is expressed through these kinds of rituals. That's not a message that is going to empower you to take action to change the circumstances that surround you. However, you can also pray in a way that, you know, asks for wisdom and courage to do things. And some people pray in that way. So prayer could go many different ways. That's my intuitive response to that piece. Wondering if that helps.
Yes.
Okay. And the second thing in terms of anger and drugs and all of that?
In the privileged middle and upper classes I'm talking about.
Yes. I'm not positive. My sense is that there is a discrepancy between being raised to believe that you have power and countering the reality in which you don't have the power to make things happen and have life be the way you want it. And so drugs and anger and a variety of other behaviors can give you an experience of power, even though they don't actually change anything or even potentially make things worse. That's how I understand it. I don't know. I'm not complete on it.
I hear what you're saying, and I appreciate that. And I wonder, these are kids who have plenty of external and internal resources. In fact, they have more than anybody. So I'm just curious.
They have some internal resources. They don't often have access to joy. They don't often have access to generosity. They don't often have access to self-connection. They don't often have access to empathy.
Well, that would include all of us.
Yes. I can't remember who it was that said, someone from Latin America who said that the people in Latin America are poor in terms of the physical realm and the people in North America are poor on the spiritual realm. The point that I take from this is that you can have a lot of external resources and still be so disconnected from yourself that you can only access certain internal resources, those designed to increase your external resources, but not necessarily those designed to give you access to a pleasurable experience of living or to connection with others. So I don't have any even remote dream that I'm going to settle all of these things even to my satisfaction. So I'd like to proceed to yet another topic. You okay with leaving it as resolved?
Yeah, sure.
Right now? Thank you. So the next piece that I wanted to look at is the question of what we do with our power. When we have power, since we have the capacity to mobilize resources to meet needs, that doesn't tell us how we mobilize the resources and what needs we're prioritizing and what needs we're not. So once we have the resources, which is the access to power, we can use them in two ways. One is to attend to our own needs, and that's the power over whether or not it meets other people's needs or attends to other people's needs. That's the power over. And the other possibility is we can attend to our needs in a way that supports other people's needs, and in particular, other people's needs for autonomy, for conscious choice for themselves. This is a very key distinction between power over and power with, and also the distinction between having the power and how we use it. Often people talk as if power over is something that you have. For me, power over is something that you intend, either consciously or not. It's the resources that you have, and the how you use them is over or with other people. So I want to just see if there's any clarifying questions before I am going to put you in a group again to discuss this. Any clarifying question about this distinction?
I'm not sure that I understand fully power with in terms of supporting needs for autonomy.
Okay.
Could you explain that a bit more?
Yes. Let's say that I'm a parent. It's a very simple relationship that is very familiar. It's very clear, I imagine, that you would agree with me that the parent has way more access to resources and therefore more power.
Yes.
So the parent can use that power over the child, which is what the overwhelming majority of parents do. A lot of parenting is a steady stream of do's and don'ts. I suppose that's not coming as surprising news to you.
No.
Now, what does power with parenting look like? Is engaging in dialogue with the child in which the child has the choice to participate in dialogue to figure out what will be the outcome together so that the child's needs are part of the equation, including the child's need for autonomy. So I'll give you an example and you'll see what I mean. And this is a real life example that happened with my sister and her son when he was 3. It was early morning and his grandparents were in a room downstairs and he was banging on the floor above their head. Power over parenting in a situation like this is taking whatever he was using to bang away from him and telling him stop banging and taking him away. Here's what my sister did instead. She said, seeing you banging on the floor, I'm worried about our guests. I want them to be able to sleep for as long as they want. Are you willing to bang on the sofa instead or not bang at all? That's the power with. She's not telling him what to do. She's telling him what is going on for her and why it matters to her, and then she's opening it to him through a request. You feel the difference?
Yes, definitely. I can see it in that example. I don't know if I'll see it as clearly in other ways that I can come back to it.
Okay. Just for the fun, I also want to tell you the end of the story to see what happens when you live like this with a child. At 3 years old, he said, I don't want to, but I'm willing. At which point he said, how come you don't want to? And he said, it doesn't wake me up. And then she says, then why are you willing? And he said, because I want to consider you. So you get it back. When you do power with, you are inviting whoever you are with to hold your needs just as much as you're holding theirs. That's the classic interdependence. So what's the situation that might not be as clear to you?
I don't have an example I can think of right now.
Okay. So I want to give you another context. Let's say, and with that I want to bring in one more piece, which is that I've alluded to but haven't expressed with full clarity, is the piece about structural power. Structural power is having access to resources by virtue of how a whole set of relationships is structured, not just my relationship with you. So, for example, if we have a company and someone is the boss, they have structural power in the sense that they can decide what is going to happen in a way that I can't. Or the example that we had before about the president of a country. And the simple measure of it is they can fire me. I cannot fire them. I can leave, but I don't have a way of affecting them. I cannot limit their access to resources. I cannot deliver consequences for their choices. If I have structural power, I can deliver consequences for your choices. I may not choose to do it. That's exactly where it's power over versus power with. I have the option of doing it. I can fire you. Is that helping?
Structural power is a trickier one for me to see how they would work. I guess I would frame it power with as being holding everyone's needs important. So it's just that shift through me around supporting our need for autonomy that I'm trying to reframe.
Okay, so for example, at BNVC, when we hire people, one of the things we ask them is, how able are you to say no when asked for something? Because the no is important. We're going to ask you to do things. If it doesn't work for you to do them, we want to hear the no. That's a way of exercising power with. Clear?
Yes.
Thank you.
It's interesting you ended with talking about saying no, and I don't mean to bring in a red herring here, but to me, power over and power with are nice and clear and wonderful alternatives because you have a choice. The choice that I keep coming up against is where I would like power with people who are asking me for something that I would really dearly love to help
Great.
Them with.
Great. We will get into this, I hope. The question of choice and how we respond to power over, I want to at least touch on it before the class is done. In other words, where you are the one with less power.
What I was going to mention, it's where more than one person or more than one group are asking for something at the same time. How kind of going with whomever came first in line and...
No. You go to needs. Remember the distinction between strategy and needs. You just connect at the level of needs, and then you find out the strategy that is going to meet the most needs. Okay?
Good for now. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so what I would like you to do in your group is to kind of like just talk out whatever you need to talk out to integrate and digest all these concepts, and also... see if you can look at least one example together and what it would look like to shift from power over to power with and back in that same situation. In other words, what would power over look like and what would power with look like in a particular situation from the side of the person with more resources? All right, so let's take another 10 minutes for this. Welcome back, and floor is open for comments and questions about the discussion that you had. It's always an unsettling moment for me when I don't hear back from anyone. It's hard for me to have feedback about how connecting the work has been.
One of the things that was shared in our group was what comes sometimes with having more external resources or internal resources can be a thought or a belief that we're better than, and that can play out in how we interact in the power over and power with dynamic.
Yes, I'm really touched by that particular insight. I can really see how it flows from it, so I'm grateful to you for noticing that. Thanks.
We talked about a situation actually having at my children's school right now where there's a fight between one parent who used protective use of force in a particular situation, and the committee's putting her with a donkey hat. She's being punished. I thought it was interesting because basically we put out a scenario with the power over, you know, where there's a situation where there's power over, and then switch to the power with. And it was basically about connection and about really connecting to your feelings, and in order for them to have a dialogue, they needed to express what brought them to take this decision. And in both cases, it was the same need. The need for security and cooperation expressed in different strategies.
Thank you. Yes, and that is really cool because it may be the same needs. The odd thing is that in the way that I look at it, when you use power with, you will end up meeting more needs. Thank you. And I am happy now to move to the last piece which has to do with choice. What choices we have and what choice means. So we have, at any point in time when there is power over that comes in our direction, we have an external choice and we have an internal choice. So to use a very extreme example, if somebody puts a gun to your head and says, give me your money or I will kill you, or they say, you know, tell me who your friends are or I will kill you, depending on who the source is, your external choice, your options are rather limited. You don't have easy access to the choice, to the option of just ignoring them and continuing to walk on your merry way, because there are likely to be consequences to that choice. And if we're not willing to live with the consequences of the choice, then we're less likely to take certain options. However, the choice is still completely available to us about how to respond. So we have the option of giving the person the money, and we have the option of not giving the person the money, and we just choose based on our willingness to face the consequences. When we don't have a lot of access to resources in the moment or in general, then our external choice is more limited. Internal choice is never limited. We can always work internally, either to bring peace to ourselves, given circumstances that we can't change, or do things such as mobilize our, let's say, empathy skills to create connection with the people who are exercising power over, in which case we might affect the outcome. So we actually have that power. This is one of the most powerful strategies. If we don't have access to internal resources, one of the most powerful strategies that we have access to as an internal choice. That's the piece that I wanted to make sure I said that came up earlier, and I want to see if there's any clarifying questions that anybody wants to bring up.
Could you just offer like an example, as you did before, that just might help?
Here's the example. I was visiting some place, and for a certain period of time, the only person that was there was the 8-year-old child. I was waiting for her grandmother, who was my friend. Meanwhile, I was having a chat with the 8-year-old. That was a very lovely chat. And at some point, she says, I can't keep talking with you. I have to go clean up my room. To which I said, no, you don't. You don't have to clean up your room. She looked at me very puzzled. And I said, if you don't clean up your room, your mother may punish you, but you don't have to clean up your room. And there was a light bulb that went in her that I could see, after which she kind of took a breath, and then she said, okay, I'm going to clean up my room because I don't want to be punished. And off she went. That's a choice. She had the possibility of continuing to talk with me and facing the consequences of the punishment later. She chose not to. That's a very different experience from saying, I have to. Is that helping?
Yes, thank you.
Any other clarifying questions or comments about choice?
Well, that did certainly clarify that last night when confronted with a choice, I did in fact make the choice. I guess in our busy lives, sometimes it really does feel like there's no time. There really wasn't time if I was going to meet my commitments to a large group of people to even take a minute to empathize mm-hmm. with someone. So I guess the option then is mourning, really.
Yes.
And perhaps I don't really know what happened because there was no time, not 1 minute today. So there has been no time to check in with the family about, so you just found out that you're going to court tomorrow for the custody of your child. this is major stuff, and it's with people that I really care about. And, you know, my mourning is, okay, that's me, but I'm really mourning not being able to, not feeling that I had the choice to assist in ways that I would have liked to.
Yeah. Thank you.
I just wanted to let you know that this stuff is very thick for me, very dense for me. It's a lot. I'm struggling no less the second time. It's a big topic. I haven't given it a lot of thought. You know, I've had little thoughts over the years about what does power look like? How do we define it? And so I'm quite slowly unfolding it.
Yeah. Yes, I think that part of what is happening is that the way that many of us are raised in our societies is to focus on the individual to such an extent that it's hard to see the structures and the systems that create a web within which we live as individuals. That's the reason I think that this is so hard to grasp. Does that give you any relief hearing this?
Yeah, it does. It does, and it makes a lot of sense.
Thank you.
I just wanted to share what this last point brought up for me. I'm part of a volunteer organization I'm very closely connected with, and there's often, it's almost like a cultural, not cultural imperative, but it's very common that senior leaders will ask volunteers, I mean people with higher power in the structure of the organization, to take on certain positions of leadership where there appears to be choice, but there really isn't. There really isn't because if people don't accept that, they feel tremendous shame, and there's such a desire to be accepted in the group, so that people end up often accepting positions and then perform the actions with a certain amount of obligation, sense of austerity rather than real joy. I was so moved when you mentioned the point a while back about fear, overcoming fear, being a tremendous source of internal resource, because it's something that I want to address with people in this group. I'm just getting my courage up to do that.
Yeah. Wonderful. Thank you.
I'm recalling a conversation years ago when I was first starting out with NVC and in conversation with someone with a lot of structural power. And I did my best to really like stay in and empathize. And I admit my ability to maybe like express was not up to par to really be vulnerable. And basically what I'm asking for is guidance in terms of this use empathy skills to create connection with the people exercising power over us, because I remember that not being a very fun conversation because I was just hearing falsehood after falsehood and I just kept coming back trying to empathize. I was like deluding myself into thinking that I could empathize this to the place where he would see the light. Never.
Okay, this is attached to outcome. I applaud that you did it at all, and it still is attached to outcome. You were empathizing with the intention of this person changing their mind.
Yeah, and you're really making the point to be open to outcome.
The other thing is that the proof is in the pudding. You check with a person. Do you have a sense that I really get where you're coming from? Until they say yes, the loop is not closed. You thinking that you heard them doesn't mean that you did. And lastly, if they have the experience of being fully heard, there is still the other side, which is getting them to hear you. The magic happens. The magic of full connection happens when both parties hear each other. Thank you. You get the final word today, I think.
Well, I'm going to ask you to have it. At the beginning of the call, you expressed that you've really enjoyed this telecourse, and I wonder if there's anything more you would like to say about that, because I'd love to hear it, about why you've enjoyed this telecourse so much particularly.
It's something about companionship in an endeavor that is so meaningful to me, which is, you know, kind of like really, really, really chewing on conceptual matters and not just the experiential of give and receive empathy. Just really, really, really engaging with theory is something that I love companionship in. Did that help?
Thank you. That's great. I really appreciate that. Yeah.
Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.